all go to the lobby. Let's all go to the lobby. Let's all go to the lobby to get ourselves a treat. Let's all go to the lobby.
Hello and welcome to Movies Versus Capitalism. This is a podcast where we watch and talk about movies from an anti-capitalist lens. I'm Rivka.
And I'm Frank.
And Frank, it's been a while since I have gone on an AI rant.
I was like, it's been a while since what? We've seen each other? I see you every day.
I know. I saw the look in your face. I was like, what am I going to lay down for you? Yeah, since we've got, I mean, it's been maybe not that long, but it's been a little. I was thinking back to.
Yeah, since we've discussed AI, for sure.
And particularly since I feel like there was a period of time where it was all, it's all I would talk about. It became my personality.
Well, it was during the strikes.
Well, it was prior to that because I was tracking. It was when rightfully so. It was like when ChatGPT first came on the scene. And we were watching a lot of robot movies, so it was the perfect storm for me.
Yeah, so what's the new AI development that we're talking about today?
Yeah, so there's a new scary thing. I'm not the only one freaking out. There's been an open AI software called Sora, which is the most recent, and this enables text to video. So we've seen with DALL-E had text to photo, which was pretty wild. This is text to video. And not only is it text to video, we haven't seen it because it's not commercially available to the public, but there is an elite class of those in Hollywood who have seen it. And it's freaking them out. It can create video content up to a minute long.
So this is, I've heard a little bit about this. This is the one where essentially you type something in and then this AI program creates like photorealistic video.
Exactly. Text to video. So, and it's not just a few seconds, which I think we've seen before. Again, this is up to a minute long, which is not going to be a feature length film, but it is significant. And of course, there are still things that it's not getting perfectly right. We know all about the hands and like a lot of just like the architecture of certain, it's still pretty lifelike. So you could ask AI to basically set your scene in a location with snow, and it can do a pretty amazing job. And so amidst the capitalist class in Hollywood who are freaking out about it, include one Tyler Perry, who freaked out so much upon seeing just a demo of Sora that he immediately put the stop on an $800 million expansion of his studio in Atlanta. He put it on hold as soon as he saw Sora, and he went to the press. He started talking about how much this scared him and why he put this on hold. And this studio would have included an expansion of 12 sound stages. He's been thinking about this for 4 years. So this is how freaked out he was about this. And there's a few things that I want to dive into with you, Frank. There's, of course, the AI stuff and what does it mean to the industry. And I think we have been having those conversations. This all feeds right back into the conversations around the strike. It's what we saw coming. It's what labor is talking about. But I thought what was particularly interesting about Perry's reaction to it was in this interview he gives with the Hollywood Reporter, he acknowledges, this is a quote from the article, "As a business owner, Perry sees the opportunity in these developments, but as an employer, fellow actor and filmmaker, he also wants to raise the alarm." And Perry says later in the article, quote, "I just hope that as people are embracing this technology and as companies are moving to reduce costs and save the bottom line, that there will be some sort of thought and some sort of compassion for humanity and the people that have worked in this industry and built careers and lives, that there's some sort of thought for them. And I think the only way to move forward in this is to galvanize it as one voice, not only in Hollywood and in the industry, but also in Congress."
That's some fucking wishful thinking from Mr. Perry.
It's wishful thinking. And we are seeing embodied, like, I just think it's a great study of the deep contradictions of capital and what Marx was warning about, right? We have the embodiment of this capitalist who is also contradictorily an actor and like in this industry, but ultimately he's recognizing like, hey,
and a billionaire.
And he's like, hey, this is really good for me as a studio owner, as the capitalist, this rocks. And I'm also freaking out and sad. I think we know based on his actions, what mattered most, like, right. He's like,
yeah,
ultimately I am not gonna like, I am not going to keep investing in this studio that could bring lots of jobs. But I think it's a really interesting contradiction. And we know these kind of contradictions are sort of what is going to lead us, you know, what is leading us, why capitalism doesn't work ultimately. But I thought this is a really interesting character study. What are your thoughts on this, Frank?
I mean, you kept saying Tyler Perry is scared. I don't think Tyler Perry is scared about this. You know, nothing is threatening Tyler Perry's material existence. He is going to remain immensely wealthy, even if AI wipes every single creative job out of Hollywood. You know, I saw a quote probably during the strike around that time, something that describes, I thought really well, how capitalism wants to organize creative labor in our modern world. And it was something along the lines of, capitalists really want human beings to be doing backbreaking menial labor for the rest of our lives, but they want robots to be creating all of our art. And I thought that really summarized this dynamic that we are seeing play out in so many different industries. You know, you think of any human labor, physical human labor that hasn't been supplanted by automation already is... those jobs are being de-skilled, they're being, assembly lined, they're being gigified, they're being exploited and crushed to the point where, you know, people, you know, garment workers make poverty wages, agriculture workers make poverty wages. But on this, on the other side, especially in Hollywood, we're seeing these fucking studios, these networks, these streamers spend so much money and so much of their political capital and their lobbying power to ensure that they can create a future where robots get to replace writers, directors, actors, musicians, artists, you know, painters, whatever. And it's incredibly depressing and troubling and antithetical to, I think, why art gets created in the first place. But to bring it back to Tyler Perry, it's not surprising. This seems like the reaction that Tyler Perry would have, which is, you know, he is a filmmaker. So he comes at it from a place of, as an artist, as a filmmaker, as a writer, as a director. So he understands how these changes are going to affect, you know, the ecosystem that he exists in. But like you said, he's coming at it first and foremost as a capitalist, as a businessman, pulling the investment from expanding his studio, which would expand physical production and roles and jobs that would go to human beings.
Well, and ultimately, I think also what's interesting about this contradiction that they're noting here, that he is both capitalist and then, I mean, he's ultimately only capitalist. You can't be both. But like his arguing for this other point of view is where the reformist mentality comes out of.
Mm.
And that these reforms, while potentially necessary to maybe, I don't know. As I'm educating myself more, I'm becoming less and less reformist. I think there could be a place for reforms potentially in this like dialectical back and forth. But ultimately, you see why he's calling for them, because he's trying to save capitalism.
Ooh,
because he's the capitalist, right? The reforms will help him further be a capitalist with like and feel good about it, and also are necessary, because without them, there's also potential for this to totally collapse, right? So you do see
That's
this
exactly
class
right.
of capitalists who do use reform and do use a lot of liberal sentimentality, because they are ultimately still trying to save this thing because they want it to maintain, they want it to work. So he really is advocating for, and I think he's not wrong about a large part of that. He goes on further in this article to talk about the solution isn't going to be us individually, DGA, SAG, WGA, fighting alone, that there's going to have to be a mass organizing effort across labor. Absolutely. But I thought that was like, what is this argument for reform? Because you're right. He's not scared. I think he's feigning the fear to justify pulling this fucking expansion, which would have provided lots of jobs to lot. Like, he's literally the first capitalist to pull out and be like, peace. And he's not wrong. Like, I don't know. He's not wrong if you look at it systemically. That's his role as a capitalist. He's like, I saw this shit. It did scare me. What scared him was, though, you're right. What scared him was, oh, shit, I almost invested $80 million when I wouldn't have to. And then my competition's not going to do that. That's what scared him.
You're so right about this. He is occupying the space of the quintessential neoliberal capitalist, which is to say, He is recognizing the contradictions and the inherent threats of this system while benefiting from it, while being able to call out the excesses of the system and say, wow, someone really should do something about this, y'all. But I'm not, because I'm pulling my investment, so I'm not going to keep creating jobs or, you know, try to invest against these developments. And then, yes, reforming the system as a way of maintaining the system. And that's something you'll hear Marxists say, which is capitalism may have, well, imploded decades ago, a century ago, you know, either during the Great Depression or the Gilded Age. There were times where the contradictions of capitalism were so great that the collapse of the system was imminent, and only through state intervention of reforming the system and basically propping up the system was capitalism able to maintain itself. If the state had just let capitalism run amok and let the contradictions play out, it might have, well, collapsed already. So yeah, very similar to what Tyler Perry's saying is, you know, let's put some guardrails on this thing so that, you know, the status quo that I came up in can be maintained.
I'm desperate to see that Sora video, though. I'm desperate to, like, see what it can do. I'm not gonna lie.
Here's a quick question before we get to our interview. I have this thought about AI technology in filmmaking. Do you think there is an ethical way for creators, let's say, like, well, here's just the example I'm thinking of. You know, I wrote an animated TV show script a few years ago. Animated television, very expensive to produce, very time consuming to produce. But I think about AI and I think, you know, if there was a program that allowed me to just put my script into an AI and I could get, you know, a, I don't know, 5-minute clip of my script produced, that would be something that I would love to, one, have and just, like, see it come to fruition. And two, that could be, you know, something that I could use to then take it out to the world and try to, you know, get people interested and maybe sell it and maybe get it actually fully produced with real animators. Would that be okay? Would it be okay for me to use an AI program to animate my script, even though I am not using real animators, but I couldn't afford to pay them to begin with, as opposed to a studio that's doing it? I don't know. I'm asking the question out loud.
Yeah, I love this question. I think it's what a lot of creators are asking, right? I think there's my limited understanding and my imperfect speaking in draft answer is, I think it presents like that interesting idea, again, we're really on our Marxist shit today, but that all objects have congealed labor inside them, and part of the efforts of capitalism is to disguise that. So by the time we get an iPhone, no one's saying like, oh, well, when I'm using this iPhone, so many people have, there's been so many different human blood, organs, bodies that have labored to put this in my hands, that it's just so alienated from that practice, that there's something about the AI of it that is also similarly, like, we know it's reproducing ideas that the people have already sweat labored to make sure that AI can recreate or create and help you in your creation of something, that there's already this alienation of other laborers, other artists who are never going to get the credit, right? And they're still working through all of that. Mm-hmm. It's hard about the morality of it all, because like we just live in such a place of alienation in that extent too. I think AI can be a tool. Is it the most creative option? I don't know. Like, are at this point, would you get your best bet from that? Would it be a useful tool? Potentially, but it also might make it not as good as it could be, because I do think, sure, AI is still artistically will always be limited because it will always be a regurgitation of something.
So am I allowed to use it? Yes or no?
Yeah, use it. I don't know.
Okay,
I don't
great.
Know.
I got sign off from Rivka.
I really don't.
I'm allowed to do
I'm
it.
I'm really like, that's, you're asking the biggest of the big questions, honestly. And I feel like there's a catch me at the right time of the month and I might believe my bullshit. You know what I mean? But today you've got the Rivka who's like, you know, try it. See what happens.
Go for it. Mm-hmm. Not wrong until someone says it's wrong. All right, yeah, so we should get to our interview for today. But before we do, we just want to remind all of our listeners to subscribe to our brand new Patreon account, because we don't sell ads on this show, and we rely on community support to keep the show going. We actually just published a bonus episode this past Friday on Poor Things, the Emma Stone, Yorgos Lanthimos Academy Award-nominated film, so that is available only on our Patreon for our paid subscribers.
And for just $5 a month on Patreon, you get access to bonus new episodes, just like the one Frank described, and our back catalog of bonus episodes. And you'll also be directly supporting the show.
You can also leave us a tip in our tip jar, and you can find all of those links in the episode description for this episode in your podcast player or by going to mvcpod.com.
You can also help us out for free by making sure to subscribe to the show and leaving a rating and review for the show on your podcast player, which helps boost the algorithm and gets the show in front of more people. And we really appreciate it.
And we also wanted to remind folks that because we don't sell ads on this show, we donate our ad space to leftist or progressive causes or organizations. So if you are part of some kind of organization, whether it's mutual aid, a worker co-op, a political campaign, or something else, we would love to promote your work here on the show. If you're interested, you can email us at moviesvscapitalism@gmail.com.
Okay, we're going to take a quick break, but we will be right back with James Haar and our discussion on Idiocracy.
Today, we are joined by James Haar. James is a Marxist educator and founder of Comrade Workwear, a brand for socialist art and apparel. James, welcome to Movies vs. Capitalism.
Hey, guys. Thank you for having me.
Very stoked for you to be here. Full disclosure to the audience, James and I are comrades IRL. We are we have hung out in the real world, and James is a great guy, and he's a brilliant guy, and I'm really excited for you to be here, James.
You're boosting me too hard right now.
I also like that was full disclosure. Like, if you don't know this, it could transform.
Yeah, we're actually best buds, guys.
Look, I've worked in journalism for the last 2 years. You have to disclose friendships. Mm. But James, so you are the founder, as I mentioned, of Comrade Workwear, which is a clothing brand, and you make artwork as well. I have a few of your shirts that you've made. They absolutely rule. So can you tell us a little bit about your background? How did you get into anti-capitalist theory, Marxist theory? And then what has been your journey that has brought you here now, where you are now running Comrade Workwear?
I'll try and give the middle size, history here. I originally came to New York to go to fashion school because I was going to be a mogul. Yeah, I was all about like Tom Ford, all these things. And then literally over winter break of freshman year, my buddy's like, you got to see this documentary. For anyone watching, it was Zeitgeist Addendum. So that's a deep cut. It's a weird one.
I actually don't know that one.
Yeah, nor do I.
It's basically, they're like, we got to be done with all the isms, like capitalism, socialism. It's the isms that are the problem. What we need is a resource-based economy. So it's just communism.
Okay.
But
okay,
yeah,
whatever.
They're like, we're rebranding.
But your in was the ism. Got it.
Yeah, I was like, yeah, fuck these isms, man.
Yeah, more than one way to skin a cat. Okay, great, cool.
Yeah. And so I come out of that and I'm like, oh my God, if this is what society really is, because, you know, they're talking about like the monetary system and sort of like debt and, you know, how it's all built to sort of fail. You know, like the idea that you're like, capitalism actually is working. Like, this is exactly it. And so I come out and I'm like, if this is the world, I got to be doing something different. So the next semester, I dropped like 4 of my fashion prereqs and did 2 poly and 2 econ theory classes. And I came out and I was like, it was worse than I thought. Yeah. And so then I
someone should tell everyone about this.
Yeah, someone's got to. So I switched majors, added a second major, added 2 minors, and it was all, like, I was so lucky I was at the new school because it's got, like, one of the most radical, Marxist educational, departments. Mm-hmm. It's hard to say department because it's, like, the whole school. And so, like, one of my minors was capitalism studies. Like, that's not something that's offered anywhere else. Yeah. So I do all that. I'm in the dual degree program, so it's 5 years, and I actually had to drop out right before my 5th year because it was too expensive. And so I'd already incurred like my hundreds of thousands of dollars of debt. And then I just had to drop out, started doing a lot of freelance design work and was trying to like found another company that was like about education. I got really into like co-ops and different like economic models. And then there's a bar down the street that I'm sure that you guys both know, Rialto Grande.
Oh yeah.
And I love their t-shirts. I bought like every single one of the t-shirts they made. And I was like, I was inspired one day. I was like, I'm going to make them a tee. And so I make them a tee and I send him the design. I'm like, you like it, right? And he's like, yeah. Don't make it. Or he's like, I don't want it. And I was like, oh, that's chill. That's chill. I was like, I still want to make one for myself. He's like, don't do that. We don't want people to like in the, Yeah, we don't want people to get in the habit of making their own merch when we're selling it. I was like, I buy everything you make. Come on. But then my girlfriend was like, you should do this. Like, you should make stuff. And I was like, no, that's, you know, fashion's always felt like a hard thing to do as an anti-capitalist, because it's like fashion is capitalism's favorite child. You know, there's that whole quote. But it became really fun to like use my art and my design stuff that I've been doing for like 15 years and actually putting it towards, you know, my own beliefs. And so that was really nice. And so now I've been doing that for almost two years. Shit. Time goes by quick. And yeah, I, you know, make fun videos and I make controversial designs. And then the goal would be to, you know, now I want to try and build it into like a real brand that supports other like leftist causes and organizations, and seeing if we can make it something real.
It's so amazing to talk to creators who are creating first from a real intention, a real theology, a real like desire to create from a certain place. And wow, that one documentary did so much for you. So you never know.
10 years.
Yeah, what your film can do. And I will have to check that one out. But we're not here to talk about that. We're here to talk about a separate movie that may have also done wonders for you. We'll find out. Did wonders for me in my watch. It was my first watch. We're talking about the 2006 movie Idiocracy, directed by Mike Judge, written by Mike Judge, Ethan Coen, starring Luke Wilson, Maya Rudolph, Dax Shepard, Terry Crews, Justin Long, and more. This movie was made for $2.4 million, and its total box office was $4,652.
What? Yeah, this movie was like a pretty famous bomb, I think.
Yeah, I think it's whack. A cult classic now, considered cult classic, but did not do well. We'll get into it.
I got to imagine just like 2006, just everyone was so sick of Bush and the Iraq War, like no one wanted to go see a political satire. That's my theory.
There's also theories that this was intentionally bailed on the marketing and distribution.
Oh, like the studio tanked it, yeah. Mm-hmm. Oh, that's also very possible.
But we'll get into it. So if you haven't seen this movie ever, maybe you're going to pause and watch it. Or you'll just listen to our synopsis and ride with us. In Idiocracy, Joe Bowers, a decisively average American, is selected as a guinea pig for a top-secret military hibernation program. Joe is forgotten, and he awakens 500 years later to discover that the United States society has devolved into an impoverished, garbage-ridden slum exclusively made up of stupid people, making Joe the de facto smartest person on Earth, who is then entrusted to fix all of the world's problems.
Some historical context for when this film was released. We already touched on it. This movie was released on September 1st, 2006. George Bush is the president. Dick Cheney is the vice president. Oh, and I should also say that we've done several 2006 movies. So, you know, these are some, we tried to find some new facts about that year. So we're not repeating the same ones every time. The No Child Left Behind Act, which was enacted in 2002, is in full swing in 2006. This federal law was aimed to increase accountability in education by requiring states to develop assessment in basic skills to be given to all students in certain grades. Twitter, an online social networking platform where users, quote, post and interact with messages known as, quote, tweets, was launched to the public on July 15th, 2006. Time Magazine's Person of the Year was you, in commemoration of all of the internet users. And you might remember that. They put like a little like reflective mirror thing on their cover. So it was like, you're just looking at an image of yourself and they're like, hey, you're the Person of the Year.
I kind of want, like, anytime anyone introduces something that's just like very normal and that we're all used to, like the way that it was first introduced. When you were talking about Twitter and they do these things called tweets and then you get into it, I kind of want that for everything.
Yeah, you should have to describe things as if like it's the advent of them and no one understands what
they
are.
At all times. Yeah. Mm.
Also in 2006, the largest corporation in the U.S. is Walmart, followed by ExxonMobil and General Motors. In July, the FBI arrests three people for trying to sell Coca-Cola trade secrets and recipes to Pepsi-Cola. What?
I don't remember. Some Willy Wonka stuff right there.
Yeah, that's some fucking Slugworth on the prowl trying to sell trade secrets. Other movies that came out in 2006 that we've covered on this podcast are Cars and Children of Men.
Quite the spectrum.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. What a year. So, James, the first thing we start the conversation with, we asked our guest, why did you choose this movie for us to talk about on this podcast?
I think this is maybe my like third or fourth time watching it. Lifetime wise, but I remember watching it as a kid and being like, this is brilliant. This is absolutely brilliant. And I haven't seen it in quite a while. And I wanted to see like how it held up. And I just remember that there was always this like core thing once I became a Marxist, you know, that I was like, oh, that movie's about eugenics. Mm-hmm. And yep. I was like, okay, I want to see outside of the eugenics if like the other commentary is good. And it is.
Yeah, I would largely agree with that. What little actual anti-capitalist critique that exists in this film is good, but largely I think you're right. This is a movie about eugenics. This is a movie about fucking population control. And I remember I had never seen this movie, but I remember around 2016, you know, Donald Trump's election. So it came roaring back into the zeitgeist. So many people being like, have you seen Mike Judge's Idiocracy, a.k.a. a documentary about the time we live in right now?
It's so brilliant.
So I think I probably watched it like 2018, 2019, 2020, right when I also started, you know, incorporating like a class or material analysis into the way that I was looking at the world and like in a more, you know, I was becoming radicalized and had a, I would say a wider view than just the standard left versus right binary, and kind of had the same reaction when I first watched it, which was just like, this is a movie that lacks really any sort of societal or systemic critique and puts all of the blame on the individuals. And the individuals in this movie being just dumb people.
Well, being poor people. And they make that very clear from the top of the movie. Mm-hmm. It's not even just stupid people. Like, they make a very clear point from the top of the film to associate class as the start of where all the stupid people come from. I mean, I agree. I watched it. I think I texted you, Frank, because this was my first time in my lifetime watching this. And I think my first text was, I was like, is this a Hillary Clinton propaganda film? What is this? Is this is why this can be used to explain, like, this movie should be used to explain how they did it, like the game plan for so much of like the Democratic propaganda and what, and so much of what they were spouting out at that time. And just the fact that people were like, this is a documentary, shows how much it was just like useful, like how that rhetoric was so useful and easy.
Yeah, basket of deplorables.
Yes, and it makes sense. I found that the watch so frustrating for the reasons you're saying. There's so much good stuff in here, but what's interesting, and I'm gonna annoy myself every time I say this, I'm reading Capital for the first time. But hey. Thank you.
Oh wow, James just held up his battered. Weather-torn volume of Capital.
How many coffee shops in Bushwick has that thing sat in? That is a...
Actually, not a lot, I promise you. I don't like to read around people like that.
Oh, well, mine is making the rounds. Every time I pull it out, I'm like, ahem.
Does anyone see?
But my point with that really annoying remark, which I've done every time we've been on this podcast, and it's going to keep happening, y'all, until I finish. It like, that was, I think, because it starts, because Capital starts at just breaking down so the bare minute, like, this is where it all begins. It was just so clear where it was like, it doesn't fucking matter, because the core start of this film has such clarity in what it's declaring the problem is.
Yeah.
And it starts with these two couples, one middle upper class white couple who's like just too smart and rich to like be able to figure out having kids.
You're like the archetypal PMC.
Exactly. And then, well, it starts with two and then it becomes many. I'd say like working class South Carolina. Like, you're just like, this is generic again, like Hillary Clinton painting working class. They throw in some Latinos in there. It's really interesting too, the racial
Southern working poor. Honestly,
exactly.
Is how, you know, like,
they're not even hinting at it. They're like, we have money. They make, like, in the dialogue, in the text, it's like, it contextualizes, like, we have money, we don't. But what it doesn't ever contextualize is, like, any kind of the material realities of that. It's just like, we don't have money, we're dumb. We have money, we're so smart.
That's the thing, is the dumb, this is the issue, is that it's actually good and well to point out lack of education as it relates to poverty. But the issue is that it's flipped. It's saying that poverty is the result of a low IQ.
Yes.
And I think the thing that was really frustrating is that the positioning of these two couples and the situation of people with less education being more prone to having more children. Like, these are all factual realities, but without bringing the social circle or like context in, you know, like notions of what's it called? Where you can like wear a condom or have birth control.
Contraception. Family planning.
Yeah, family planning, contraception. You know, like notions of patriarchy, which are super, super dominant throughout the entire film, and like male dominance as a thing, and not to mention like social or cultural pressures, that all of those things are the factors, not to mention like we could just bring in like just notions of areas and having tax funds going to their education system and why these things are happening. But they go, Billy Bob over here has a low IQ. It's an 86 IQ, and Nancy and whatever have 140. And those people aren't having kids and these ones are. That's a factual reality. But without saying these people don't have access, they're not given the ability to bring up their IQ, which is obviously in and of itself a pretty fucked up like metric.
And then the movie goes on to conflate, which certainly there's ignorance and lack of education, but it completely conflates all of that with like being morally decrepit. Like, you're inherently then racist, homophobic. All these things are just like all together. There's no room to maybe not have access to education and not be a homophobic piece of shit, like, which we know is just a ridiculous conflation that worked really well for Hillary Clinton.
You know, the 06 context is actually really important, because Obama, in his own like speeches, he regularly talked about like issues of black poverty or like black crime or whatever. It was always actually about like cultural deficiencies. We hadn't got to the point where the Democratic Party was even okay mentioning sort of like systemic critiques or systemic racism or anything like that. You know, there's that great article from Obama to Coates talking about like the sort of liberal critique of the black experience in America. And so it's so funny to see that cultural sort of critique that, you know, we think of like Obama's this progressive whatever. But that's what was progressive then. Was they like, those are just moral failings.
Because it's so much easier. It's so much easier to place all of the blame on the individual than to, for like a second, even admit one's own culpability as someone who maintains the system that is the system that actually creates these dynamics.
Or even like lack of culpability. Like, I think it's really scary when you start to wake up to this. At least I find it scary when you're like, wait, I don't have as much power individually as like I've been told. That puts you in a really important position. But I think that to me is like one of the scarier parts, when you're like, wait, I can't make all the changes all alone. If I just like wake up one day on the right side of the bed and do all the right...
I'm going to recycle so good.
Yeah. I'm going to use so many metal straws.
There's actually something that was really funny to me about this, because obviously right after they present these two people and like the one's family tree gets giant because dumb people be fucking, I guess, that then they go to this dystopic future where there's just like trash mountains and it's... I mean, well, that's just kind of now, but whatever. And I love the idea that it was about the moral failings and the low IQ people destroying the planet effectively, when it's the same way they're framing it. It's like, it's those very good people, those rich people, those high IQ people that are the ones that are actively doing it right now.
Yeah.
And I thought that was a really kind of like weird, fucked up, but funny representation.
Yeah. And that the upper class PMC people are completely blameless in this situation. But that's also like that PMC couple is the same couple that says like, oh, I never would have voted for Bernie because our taxes would have gone up. And, you know, like are also responsible in their own way for maintaining the status quo.
Just on that couple, I think also there's like an important storytelling device that lots of things do where you're like, well, we set them up to be annoying enough. Like, we're making fun of both of them. But again, you're like, the consequences of them being really annoying and like having sticks up their asses and just not being able to mate. You're like, you're still suggesting again that they just have better DNA. They're a better breed of human. It's pretty. It's pretty terrifying. I had to rewatch to be like, wait, is it really just that, like, from the top making that argument? And actually, Mike Judge, I think, was reading a dysgenics book. Like, it wasn't even like he was like, oh, accidentally. It was like he was reading this. There was a 1996.
Like, I'm reading the bell curve.
Well, he was reading, I think I read somewhere, I could be, I'm pretty sure I'm right. But there was a book that Richard Lynn wrote in 96 called Dysgenics, Genetic Deterioration in Modern Populations. And I know that he was, Mike Judge was thinking about these things. I'm pretty sure he'd read that book. So this is where this came from. It wasn't like he accidentally made a eugenics argument. It's like very much like, I'm going to write this.
Mike.
This is a good idea.
Yeah, don't go on record, my guy. You know, like, keep it to yourself. Though, like, even if he hadn't read that book, like we're saying, and Rivka, you said, this feels very much like the Democratic Party establishment liberal wisdom that the problem in this country, the only problem, is that we got this half of the country that are just a bunch of dumb, fucking racist, homophobic idiots who vote against their own interests and are so stupid that they don't even know what's good for them. And you don't need to read a eugenics book to come up with that theory. And
no,
we're seeing
it's what you do on the schoolyard. It's the easiest. Like, when I'm mad at someone, that's what I say. It's not accurate. I'm just like, you're dumb.
And we're seeing it play out right now in probably the most stark, exaggerated form that it has ever taken, you know, with everything that is happening in Gaza right now, with the people that are still clinging to the Democratic Party and Biden jumping through every hoop and doing every sort of mental gymnastic to be like, No. Actually, Biden is actually really great. And the whole thing is that you guys just don't. Everyone else is a fucking moron who doesn't understand that the Democratic Party actually has everyone's best interests at heart. Quick sidebar on Biden and his age. Do you think, like, he to anyone in his circle has been like, I don't want to fucking die being the president. Fucking let me.
He's like,
just
I'm so fucking over
I'm
this.
So
guys.
Fucking tired, guys. I'm no. so fucking tired. I just want to hang out with my grandkids and eat ice cream. Please let
Not
me go.
Not at all. Yeah. Not at all. He's like, I'm the captain of this plane. Like, I think he's.
I don't think he's alive. Actually, I don't think he's alive. I think he's puppeted.
It's like a Dave situation where they found a body double, or is it like a Weekend at Bernie's where they are literally propping up his corpse?
I think they're propping up his corpse. I think that, like, the same thing. I think there's like four different people that they're just being puppeted just by some guy up in the rafters.
I mean, I wouldn't be surprised
certainly
if we have
puppeted,
that technology.
For
now.
Sure.
The last thing I want to say before we get too far away from just like the way that this movie paints the stupid people, like both in the present day and then in the future dystopian world where it's only stupid people, Judge really chose to take aim at like very discrete social groups, specifically like you're saying, James, like the white working poor of the South, Black and Latino communities, and sex workers. So generally speaking, like some of the most vulnerable sections of the working class. And that's everyone that Judge deems to be like stupid and worthless in this world.
Yeah, the prostitute part, I was like, I definitely didn't remember that. And I also didn't realize that, like, I think there's only like two women with speaking roles in the entirety of the movie. One is Maya Rudolph.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, Maya Rudolph.
One is Maya Rudolph, a prostitute, and most of her lines are like about her trying to evade her pimp.
So weird.
Mm-hmm. And then there's the redhead that, because she's a part of the dumb society, I don't even want to like try and replicate how she talks, but it was super super sure. fucked up. But there was something you said earlier where you're like, outside of like a couple things, I actually think this is like a super amazing anti-capitalist critique. If we divorce it really quick from Mike Judge and like this entry point of the stupid people thing, because outside of the idea that it's from stupid people, if you know out the gate, like, let's say we're just reading Capital or whatever, that any of these things, even the dyad between the TV, like when that guy gets off his chair and it's like a toilet and, you know, like a straw, and there's like the TV with ads all surrounding, I'm like, this is,
that shit is great.
Yeah, like this really is a solid representation of like a capitalist dystopia where Carl's Jr. can take away your kids because you screamed out that like they were hungry or something.
Best joke in the movie.
It really is one of the best jokes. But like, you know, there's all these things about the relationship between capital and the state and this like convergence of corporate capital power and state power and how it creates these incredibly fucked up situations. Like, and it's all centered around the consumer. They're like increasing this like consumer society. It's all about the degradation of the ecology because you're putting profits first. It's all about the ways in which this one was a weird one. I was surprised they did it, but like the barcodes on their
wrist
on their wrist, and they're now all these things about operating in an incredibly, like, in a surveillance society. Like, yeah. There's so many things that are amazing social critiques if it wasn't centered on the idea that poor people are poor because they're stupid, and if we let the stupid people keep being stupid, we're going to get to this world. If you take
that, it would be amazing to take this film and be able to edit it so you could, like, adjust certain things and keep certain moments, because I agree with you. That's what was so frustrating. And it was so frustrating. But again, that frustration, I think, mirrors our political crisis and our political moment. But it also offers hope that you're like, I think people can see this, but, like, people are just wrong. They just don't understand the where it generates from, like, the genesis, where it starts. And so we're actually, it's actually, like, so possible. It's the reason I think moments, like, as we've been seeing, there's a radicalization, like, in those moments of crisis. It's not that hard for people to jump. It's not, like, even that radical a jump. You're just like, oh, let me just adjust my prescription here. I can see completely differently. This makes a lot more sense. But I've always been seeing, like, the mountains of garbage. I just thought it was the stupid people, because that's what they were telling me, you know? And now this makes a lot more sense that it's not the stupid people. It's like the incentive to just create a bunch of shit. Like, that's literally where the garbage is coming from.
Yeah.
Rivka and I were chatting the other day about the movie. We had, like, a little a background conversation on Idiocracy. And Rivka, you said, you were like, this movie could work as is if you just changed the prologue. And instead of the prologue being stupid people had too many kids and smart people didn't, and now that's why the world is shitty. If you just change that into, like, in the early 21st century, American society decided to privatize every single form of government and institution. Like, every single thing was privatized, resulting in private ownership of every single function of human society. You could just do that and then flash forward to the exact same movie, and a lot of it would still make perfect sense. But it would actually have this societal structural critique that we want it to have.
Okay, so let's get into those, like, the details of this world that do work really well, that could, in our fictional, like, reimagining of the beginning, will make so much.
I'm excited.
Will be really good. While I didn't find much of it funny, which was disappointing.
It's fair. It's very broad humor.
It was so disappointing. What a great setup. Are you kidding me? The dumbest people in the world. That's, like, the most you can come up with. Like, I just thought there was, you know, it was just very base. And I just think in terms of comedy, that's, like, to be the most anything, but to be the dumbest person, that's, like, so fun. And I just think there was not enough funny.
Well, it's super emblematic of, like, the time where I'm going to get canceled for just quoting this movie right now, where he's like, oh, you talk like a fag and your shit's all retarded. Like, that is the humor of that time.
Yeah.
No, the whole thing. And they do. And it's not once, it's
constant.
Batters you over the head.
Constant.
And it's a perfect example of why people are like, well, it was a matter of the time. It was funny. You're like, everyone's leaving this movie saying that word. All those words over and over and over, quoting it to their friends. It's
fucking, and if they're not saying those words, a lot of people in this movie are doing voices and character work that is borderline like playing mentally challenged people. Like Dex,
that's all it is.
Yeah,
that's
like Dax Shepard in this movie is, like, full on going for it.
Or the Secretary of Education guy.
No, it's a lazy, just like craft wise comedic choice. It's just not. It's just the lowest hanging fruit, and so it just didn't make me laugh. But I did love the detail. I thought the best point was, like, the detail of the world. We're in 2505, and yeah, just the set design's incredible. So let's start with just kind of this, like, the commodification of the world and the consumerism gone wild and the trash mountain. Like, what did you think of just the material realities of the world? You kind of got into it, that everything is branded.
Okay, I have a host of small things that I loved out the gate. I mean, the first was when he goes, so he comes in this room and he, like, crash lands. He gets out of his like cryo tank or whatever, and he's in Dax Shepard's house. And Dax Shepard at this moment is sitting on a giant Lazy Boy that is also a toilet that also is plugging in, like, it's got, like, a soda drink, or maybe it's Brondo. I don't know. So in this movie, Brondo owns everything. It's the Thirst Mutilator. It's basically Gatorade.
It's got electrolytes.
Or, like, I always imagine it like Mountain Dew meets Gatorade.
Yeah, it's like that's their child. And this is all I see anyone eating like almost the whole time. It's just like some sort of like white yellow goo that's coming out of a thing, but it kind of looks like nacho cheese. I don't know.
Food paste.
And then he's looking at this TV, and I'd say like 50% of the visible interface is just ads. And so I think that there's an interesting thing that happens currently with social media, which is trying to individualize and create like a dyad between you and a screen, because the screen can feed you both entertainment, but it also can feed you advertisements to purchase, just basically to consume and consume and consume. And so making this dyad between the screen, which is constantly adding you, and then you're at a place where you never have to get up, was the first thing that I thought was kind of brilliant. You know, you're like, I can eat here, I can shit here, and I can watch here.
Hold up, be really honest.
Do I want it?
Did you want it?
Do we want like a recline, like a toilet recliner?
Be so fucking honest. Like when I saw that, I was like, this was a child of the 90s. I was like, that's what I always dreamed of.
I don't really want to shit where I eat, literally.
I'm not saying now, Frank.
You're covering the hole, though, the whole time. That's the brilliant part of it.
I mean,
all the shit particles have nowhere to go.
You're too good. You're better than me. I was like, wow, there's a part of me that's like, want to try it at least.
I mean,
if it wasn't just a toilet, if there was a thing that could handle everything and bring it somewhere else, maybe. I don't know.
Maybe it's like the first time you use a squatty potty and you're like, I'm never going back now.
Yeah,
so,
never going back.
I'm not ruling it out.
No, it's brilliant. It's a brilliant, like, they should at least do this as like a theme park. If they're really, if this movie had done any better, they would have like really commodified it and you could go sit on that thing for like a picture.
The other aspect of that scene is the programming that Dax Shepard is watching, which is like, it comes back throughout the movie which is a TV show called Ow My Balls, which, as you can imagine, is just a guy getting hit in the balls. And this is something that you see in like some dystopian filmmaking. I think RoboCop does this, which is like, it shows how if you allow the way capitalist entertainment is organized to just like continue on to the most absurd degree, then it's going to dumb down culture to the most just like sensationalized, violent, in your face and broad type of humor. I think in RoboCop, it's like, I'd buy that for a dollar. And it's like some guy smashing pies into people. This is like a theme you see in dystopian movies. It's like, how dumb can culture get for this future?
Yeah, Boots Riley does it really well. And Sorry to Bother You, it comes up time and time again.
I also love the way that this, as cheap as this movie is and looks, it like, it kind of works for it in some ways. The sets are cheap looking, but it also, it just looks so disgusting. Like there is garbage everywhere. And I love how all of the hardware and infrastructure in this movie is old and dirty, even though it is the future. And even though they are like interfacing with technologies that we don't have and are like very advanced technologies, they still look just like old and grimy and shitty because they just have been under service for so long. Like the movie's aesthetic, as disgusting as it is, like I think really works
for it.
It's
beautiful. Do you notice how everyone's wearing synthetic? They're wearing like the same thing. It's just different types of like striped brand logos, but they're all some shiny synthetic material.
Again, kind of wanted it.
I know, no. The uniforms, like, the prison uniforms are so tight.
The spandex on the prison guards, like, kind of want our police to dress like that.
That'd be hilarious. You know, the like Crocs weren't even really like a thing yet. And then the guy that was doing the concept work and the fashion, building out the costumes, basically discovered Crocs for this movie, because he's like, what's like a stupid, it's future looking shoe, but it's also super stupid.
You're unpacking the fashion dialectics between Idiocracy and Crocs.
You brought up the idea of like capitalist media going to it's the most sensationalized thing, which is like, could it happen? And I think that it's really easy to imagine just like a linear thing, like a linear decline of like intelligence or media or whatever. But I think, as Marxists, as we should, it's about a dialectic, you know, and I think that we swing from different, you know, levels. And so I think we've even seen our media go from in the 2000s, maybe being a little bit more sensational, a little bit more stupid, a little whatever, where I think you see a stronger pushback these days to authenticity, towards criticality, towards maybe like actual like artistic craftsmanship. And so I think that the same way that I'm hoping that we're at one extreme of like the media literacy space, you know, there's like a lot of utopian ideas about having access to all this information, like all of a sudden we're all going to be so smart. And then people are like, oh, but, and then we got to the point where it's like, well, no one trusts any institution anymore. And everyone's getting fake news and all that stuff. But I think just as much as it happens, and then I think we come back and we find a new way. So I found myself wondering if we could ever actually get to any level of this, because I feel like our dialectical relationship with any of these things would necessarily pull us back at some point.
Well, that's so interesting, because I felt like, I guess this is the people who are sort of aligned with the, like, it's a documentary. I was like, there was so much that I was like, yeah, we're there. Like, this isn't shocking. I mean, there literally are avalanches of trash.
Trash.
That's not happening. I mean, the Hit My Balls show, yeah, seen it.
Yeah, we have Wipeout.
Love Fear
Wipeout.
Factor, like all the things. We have all the things. But I'm with you. I think that's hopeful. That's a hopeful way to think about the dialectics. And
at least for me, hearing that, James, it kind of feels like both things are true, in that, like, there are people, whether it's in, you know, more establishment media or in independent media, that are trying to create a more, like, thoughtful, nuanced, critical, either, you know, form of entertainment or, you know, news or any kind of media. But then on the other side, yeah, we have Wipeout, we have TLC, you know, which is
don't
just
forget,
like,
Bravo, my boy.
Bravo,
the Kings.
TLC, which is poverty porn, and then Bravo, which is just like wealth porn. Netflix has a show called Naked Attraction where people just stare at your dick and are like, I date that dick. So
is that how that one goes? I saw it, but
yeah, I haven't watched it. Someone described it to me. If you haven't heard of it, Netflix has a show called Naked Attraction where they show a person naked from the bottom to the top, and as they scroll up, you're like, it's a pretty good looking dick. Those are pretty good looking tits. Yeah, I think we could do this.
It's got weird balls, though. I don't know about those.
That is the premise of the show. So,
wow.
So, yeah. So, in that dialectic, I think both things are happening simultaneously. Mm-hmm.
Well, I guess that's the other critique I would have of the movie, if it's even worthy of. But there's, like, absolutely no resistance. There's nothing. There's nothing in this world until Joe.
Average Joe.
Average Joe, Luke Wilson, perfectly cast, enters in, which is just like, fuck you. Like, I just don't believe anything could be that one-dimensional with human beings. I don't like that premise at all, that there's not a single person there in resistance to, like, they've all just, again, it's the eugenics thing. If you go on that, they're just so, they just can't, they just don't have
just
the
stupid
individual.
And docile, you know what I mean?
Right. But then, okay, another detail that we kind of touched on that I thought was the most successful moment of the movie was the Carl's Jr. scene when he comes across, and it's the only time there's also in this world another mention of, well, there's mentions of economics, but like a material, like how you get a glimpse of like how it may be impacting a family, because it's this woman banging, like trying to get her jumbo fries, where you assume you're like, this is where they get food. It's a Carl's Jr. thing. There's some great dialogue there, including like, please come back when you can afford to make a purchase. And she says something. It's essentially, you get the sense that she has a family and they're going to starve now because she can't afford to make this purchase. It's
I think she says, my kids are starving.
Yes.
Yeah, yeah.
My kids are starving. It's the only moment there's like a mention of like, oh, maybe like people are actually aware that like they're not just docile and like eating slime. Maybe they're like suffering a little. Like, where's the human suffering? I wanted like.
Well, the immediate follow up is actually, I think, kind of brilliant too. So, because there is like state and corporate violence, you know, like the police are effectively under the control of both. And so, first, Carl's Jr. has the license to just like spray them with some sort of drug that makes her more docile. Then Carl's Jr. says, you're an unfit mother. Carl's Jr. is now taking like possession of your children. Yeah. And then within like a minute and a half, the cops are there to arrest her for being an unfit mother. And I liked the idea. It's like they only have one real moment where they're talking about poverty. And the first thing that happens to that person is to be disappeared by the police.
Yes, that was one of the strongest moments in the movie. Yeah. And your children will be placed in the custody of Carl's Jr. That's an all-time line.
Just to delve into the Carl's Jr. for a moment. I didn't do any research on this. I probably should have. Like,
did they sign off on that?
Yeah. Because what I thought, this movie reminded me too of Josie and the Pussycats. It's like a really, it's almost like that world, but in its late stage form. Did you see that? Have you seen that movie, James?
I have not seen it, no.
Highly recommended. I think you would love it.
Oh,
it's like,
yeah.
It's like the this world, but in color. Like, it's pre this world, but it's like the hyper colorized. Like, it's the successful consumerism.
Okay.
But it really didn't feel, Frank, to you like it was like this so similar in terms of like how everything was branded. Everything was like very colorful, but it could be this world and just everything slocked down.
Yeah, it's also very much got that like mid 2000s aesthetic. Yeah.
But in the making of that, all those brands were like also like it's all Target. It's all, you know, but they're all benefiting from being in that movie. And that movie was very well marketed. In this conspiracy of like maybe why this wasn't well marketed. Also, like, I would assume this is still great. This is still great for Carl's Jr. Like, I'm, you know what I mean? Psychologically, I'm like, this is still a great ad. They're saying it over and over. It's all I can think about is like Costco and Carl's Jr.
Big ass fries. Yeah, like I wanted some Carl's Jr. I mean, I also think it's pretty emblematic of the time that you can have that scene with the mother and that Carl's Jr. would sign off on it because they're like, it's not bad because there is no systemic critique. You know, so like they did nothing wrong. It's just like it's a poor person. They can't afford it, whatever, you know, and I think that maybe that's it.
Yeah. There was an important line, too, that I wanted to mention. That's the other moment that sits up, says like mentions any kind of system. And the narration says when Joe is like entering this world, the economy was in a state of deep neglect. So that's what's wrong. And it's again made clear like capitalism is not the issue. The issue is just that these morons like started neglecting things. So, and later I think with Brando, which we should get into, it contradicts that. We think there's maybe something else going on, but the narration I think makes it very clear how we're meant to see this. Like, this is an issue of like, just put the water instead of the Gatorade and you'll be fine.
Do you guys see the jackpot though? Oh, when he finally gets to the, you know, because he's like all drugged up and then he gets to the hospital. And he's just see a dude on like a slot machine and it's to win healthcare.
Oh, I missed that. Oh, shit. Yeah.
That's see the best stuff.
That's
with
great.
The details.
Yeah, that's great.
I feel like the set designer, like the production design people were low key lefties.
I love that. Yeah, yeah.
That's possible because like a lot. Yeah, it was a lot of the world building that actually had some of the best critique. Before we get too far away from the cops, I thought the way that they portrayed cops in this world was like very funny and effective. In that, like, every time the cops show up, they just open fire on everyone and everything. It's like there's no investigation. There's no,
the
like,
auto even, turrets.
Yeah, the when he escapes from the prison and the auto turrets are just immediately trying to take him out. All that stuff was great. And it's just like, yes, this is what the police state would evolve into in this world. We're just going to meet every single situation with just unbridled violence.
Yeah, so all the cops, if you notice, like, most of them have Carl's Jr. tattoos.
Oh, I didn't notice that either.
See?
Wow. Yeah.
Great
that
world
was,
building.
That was something. Also, I know I keep bringing up the state corporate nexus here of power. It was also kind of like beyond its time or you know, whatever, for the idea of the barcode and its relationship to your access to anything. There's the moment where he's an escape convict and his barcode gets scanned and then the car that he's in with Dax Shepard shuts down. No longer has access. And then the unbridled violence comes in where six or seven policemen descend on it, one with like a full blown like RPG rocket launcher, and then they just set it ablaze. Yeah. But the idea that the moment that in the eyes of the state or in the eyes of the corporation, you are, you know, unfit now, that your access to anything and everything is cut off. Like, they can just turn it off right there. And that's, like, one of the things we're talking about, like, housing being on the blockchain or on any of these. There's, like, all these utopian fantasies. But it's, like, the reality, if any of those technologies were injected into our current economic world, would be the moment you can't pay your rent, you can't unlock your front door anymore. You know what I mean? You get locked out of your house. Or you get... And I think that I thought it was kind of a brilliant little moment. Because you don't really see it outside of that one moment. The barcode, as like a plot mechanism, happens quite a few times just to like let the police or whoever know where they are. But that one thing was like, I think the only time that the access was cut off.
And something happens in the Costco too, I think. And it's like also you're broadcasted immediately all over the entire world, like on all
that,
the TVs.
That too, yeah.
So the other like big plot line in this movie that I think a lot of people took to in 2016 was when we get introduced to the president of the United States, played by Terry Crews, who I believe is a, in this world, a former wrestler.
And porn star.
And porn star. And I think that was a thing. That was a thing a lot of people, especially liberals, latched onto in 2016, being like, see, look, it's a documentary. But there is some valid and I think accurate stuff that is in here about how politics has been turned into spectacle. And in this world, it is taken, again, to the most extreme version where, like, it's basically like a giant stage performance that the president is doing anytime he comes into, you know, the halls of Congress. So, yeah, so I like that part of it was, I thought, was strong. Was there any other part of like how they portrayed politics or the presidency that you thought was particularly strong?
They had a small nepotism moment, which was probably flew under the radar, where the Secretary of Education, who is just a dude not playing well, just like is the most fucked up way you could possibly imagine, playing someone with a mental handicap. So there was that one. And yeah, outside of that, I don't know if I saw anything that was especially important. There was one thing, because the porn star thing just came up, and it's a quick note, was how every single business or every corporation pretty much became a sex, you know, like some kind of like
a sex parlor as well.
Like a sex parlor. Yeah.
Starbucks.
Starbucks for sure. But yeah, like they showed like a bunch of different brands where that's where what happened. Like, I know what the critique is. They're like sex sells. So they're going to make everything be sex. But it also felt like one of those like really like limp dick liberal takes on like their understanding of capitalism.
Yeah. It was another one of those where I'm like, oh, so fucking close. Like a lot of these things where you're like so close and maybe we can change it just by changing the prologue.
Yeah.
But the idea, like in general, I thought one of the strongest things that would happen was just how they portrayed just the alienation, the level of alienation from money and sex and capital. Like the characters, there was a character that was going around just like, oh, it was Frido Pendejo, who is Dax Shepard's character. His name is Frido Pendejo. And Jesus, he was just like this
guy. Jesus.
This theme of like, I like money. And they would just say it all. They're like, oh, I like money. And and just, I did appreciate the portrayal of like, when they got past like, oh, I'm playing some weird generalized special needs, which is ridiculous. It was like, no, you're alienated from money so much. You don't know what you're talking about. And that translated directly to how they dealt with sex. They're like, I like having sex with chicks, and he would do all these like sex moves, and you're just like, if you could take it there, it would be clear that none of these people are having any kinds of sex. Like what's probably happening inside of these Starbucks, like, you know, is not sex as we know it. There's no pleasure. There's just like everything is devoid. It's just, again, everything in this world is just, I know I'm supposed to like money and fetishize money, but I have no idea why. Same with sex, but they don't
connect it. Yeah, they could do a thing that's just like everything is commodified, including every single person's body and what they and like what their body offers. Like that's an easy way to just connect it, but they don't do it.
And I think it would have sold if we didn't have Rita. Like Rita made it to the way they commodify her because she is their flesh and blood, like being this female portrayed. When they start to sexualize her and that she's portrayed as just so one-dimensional, and they just make her like, I don't understand why she had to be so dumb, like why she had to really be like, upgrades coming for me. It was just like, now you're just making a really dumb racist joke and like sexist joke about it. Just was so unnecessary. Even
there's
in
so
2006
many,
I was
yeah
like,
there's so many
even
setups for like an actual critique at any of those points. The fact that she's the only, there's clearly an immense amount of sex workers. Prostitution's legal, they say that. No real, you know, like talking about how prostitution could have become legalized, you know, because everyone's destitute now and they need to like open up black market areas of the economy so that like certain people can function more or whatever. Like there's so many things there. And so I just thought of this and I just don't want to lose it. So I'm going to put, you asked about the politics thing. There was one critique that I did have, which was related to them trying to execute Joe Bauer. Luke Wilson. Joe Bauer. John Wilson. How to.
Great show.
No, so they're trying to execute him because he said to water the crops with water and not with Gatorade. And it's taking a while for the plants to grow. And so, like, the idea that the poor people need to stop like having outcry against politicians, because it just takes time for these things to happen, guys. You just gotta wait. Obviously, like in this, it's a much shorter time span. You know, for a sprout, you maybe need like 2 weeks or, you know, 4 weeks or something like that. But I think if you wanted to extrapolate that, it's like attention spans are so short, people are so demanding in this time sensitive thing that, like, guys, we're working on poverty, we're working on inequality, we're working on the climate. You just need to be fucking patient with us and stop with all this outcry. There seemed like there was something there.
Wow, there's a lot here. I think the real idiocracy is how much Mike Judge missed this. That's like,
well, that brings us to the strongest anti-capitalist part of this movie, which is like the Brondo, which is, again, like this Gatorade, Mountain Dew, the thirst mutilator. When they explain why it has supplanted water for every major use in human society, they say, in the early 21st century, the Brondo Corporation realized that water was eating into their profit margins. So they bought the FDA and they replaced other than the toilet, everything that used to get water is now getting Brondo.
So they bought the FDA and they bought the FCC. So not only Brondo become the thing that is doing like everything, you see it, but it's also the monopolization part of it too.
It's a monopolization part of it. And then that's the reason that everyone freaks out and the economy tanks, is because as soon as they hit Brondo's profit margins at all by using water for the crops, then the entire stock market crashes, which is another great critique on like monopoly and the outsized influence that the fucking stock market has on, you know, like actual like material economic factors in people's lives. Like all of that was there, but just didn't connect the dots.
Yeah. Or even just the idea that doing something that's like good for the environment and for people might not be good for business, you know?
Sure.
Like, oh, they're so close. That's all I kept thinking the entire time. I'm like, you guys are so fucking close the whole time.
But they could never, but they set themselves up. Like there's no way they could have made that, because again, even if you make the point about the profit margins and profit running amok, it's their thesis is it's because the dumb people took over.
Yeah.
And not because that's how the system was meant to work from the beginning of time. Like, this isn't just working. And so the intervention has to be systemic change. It's because the dummies just let this happen.
It's the bad apples argument that we would have for cops, but for literally everything that's happening.
Yeah.
Yep.
And it's interesting because, well, so I wonder what you thought of it. Another thing I was like, this is kind of cool that we don't really have like a singular evil bad guy CEO, which is what like a lot of the films that we've reviewed that try and make a critique of capitalism fall into that trap of like, it's this one dude. If we could just not have this one dude. And they have the Brondo guy screaming. But I liked that there was this generalized sense of like corporation has taken over.
Yeah.
And you can't pinpoint it, but it needed. But again, it just, because of the setup, it failed. Again, it failed because it was going to be resolved by Luke Wilson and his mediocre milquetoast brain reproducing. Yeah. And that's how the film ended. That's the solution at the end of the movie. He, surprise, surprise, gets together with Maya Rudolph.
All we need is just one smart guy to fix it for everybody. That's it.
No, all we need is one average white man.
Yeah.
We just need the most average white man. And he's going to fix everything. No, this is one last thing that I want to say about the corporate government unity. When they go to get on the phone, the company is AOL, Time Warner, Taco Bell, U.S. government.
That's fucking great.
That's so funny.
Did either of you have anything else you wanted to hit before we do the awards?
We hit a little bit on rehabilitation, but I think that was strong as well. And sort of the extension of the government and the court system, that the way they deal with anything is like you go to, I guess it's, what would you call that? Like,
what are they called?
Monster truck rally.
Monster truck rally?
Or roller derby? No, that's on roller skates.
Well, it's sort of like, it's a monster truck rally, gladiators.
Gladiators, yeah. And I had fun in that part. I just thought that was like a fun, I liked the spectacle of the court system and all that. I thought that could have been a really strong point as well.
Yeah, I mean, just the general carceral approach to everything in this movie. A lot of strong stuff to talk about there.
It's wild that he made this movie, what, like 5-6 years after Office Space? And Office Space is still pretty much perfect. But I guess it was Office Space is looking at a much smaller workplace ecosystem. So, like, rather than, like, society as a whole.
I bet if we went back, some of the red flags were there.
Oh, I'm sure.
You know what I did like? I'm gonna save this one. In the hospital, when he goes in, and he's like, I don't know, I'm like, my joints are kind of achy, and I'm feeling kind of sick. And I was like, I loved the doctor user interface where she's just going over like pictographs of like different ailments.
That is the experience. That was really real. Okay.
Awards.
Let's give this movie some awards. Our first award is for best politics. This goes to the character with the best politics in the movie.
Honestly, I don't know if we have any candidates for this.
The mother whose kids got taken away by Carl's Jr.
Yeah. Yes.
Or President Camacho.
Okay. Let's hear the argument.
Well, if there isn't actually a solution to a problem, you know, because whatever. The world is the world that they're in. We don't like that whole portrayal. But that's the world they're in. And he goes, this guy's smart. Let's let the smart person fix the problem. Let's let the person that we think is gonna know how to do something. That would be like us saying, hey, we know the climate's going to shit. I acknowledge there's a problem. Let's go to the climate scientists and see what we should do and let them take charge. You know?
That's fair.
Yeah, I'm sold.
All right. It's tied between the mother who had her child taken away from Carl's Jr. and President Camacho, the wrestler / porn star. Okay, our next award is worst politics. Goes to the character with the worst politics in the movie.
Mike Judge.
Yeah.
Yeah, that's the correct answer. It could be the Dax Shepard character, Frito Pendejo. That's such a bummer that that's his name. He does all of the terrible things that we've mentioned, like, you know, just being very homophobic and racist and all that stuff. But again, it's like not his fault because he is what the world hath wrought. So it's, you know, how much of it is actually his own doing. But that, yeah, is there any other one, anyone else that
worst has like actually politics?
Discernible bad politics?
I would say the closest that we got to like Brando, that guy who was like screaming at the camera, who was probably the closest to anyone in power with this corporation, would probably be the worst. If there was anyone, that was the other thing. I was like, who's profiting now? Who's benefiting? And it's really interesting if it was a world in which like capitalism has gotten so far like ahead, it's just like into the infinite of needing to like just create profit and capital, and it's just no one's benefiting anymore. But it never made that statement.
Yeah, I just realized this, they only showed like three jobs.
Oh yeah,
like one was one was prostitute, one was effectively like a politician person, and then the other one was like a doctor or like a person working in a hospital. There was no other work being done.
No, but then they allude to the fact that when the water gets switched,
a bunch
over,
of people lost their jobs.
Presumably everybody.
Yeah.
But no one seems to be working. Yeah, it's very strange.
So I'm going to put one guy in the running for worst politics, and I'm not sure if he really has any politics. It just was the one that made me feel the grossest when I heard it. And it was the one prison guard, or like not prison guard, but like police security force for them when they're politicians. And Luke Wilson's character goes to talk to Maya Rudolph like in the bushes, presumably, or like they lie and they're like, we're going to go fuck. But it's just like to talk about an escape plan. And then he comes in and he's like, asks one if they can run train on her.
Yeah, gross.
Yeah, and then like also one of the most grotesque sort of objectification of women parts and like sexual violence part that just made me feel gross.
Yes, it was so gross. Yeah, fuck him.
That's a good nominee. Yeah, and he's a cop. Yeah.
And he's a cop.
Yeah, that one, he wins. All right, and our last award is Best Supporting Character / Spinoff. So this goes to your favorite supporting character and maybe, you know, a spinoff you would want to see if you want to continue watching people exist in this world.
My first is going to be Camacho again. You know, maybe he takes two awards home because I would watch the Camacho spinoff 100% or like a Camacho prequel. I don't know. And then the other one, if you guys stayed to watch the after credits scene, it is Upgrade, the pimp.
Oh, man, I'm going to have to go back and watch now. I have to see that.
What happens in the post credits scene?
He pops out of one of the cryogenic freezing thingies.
He makes it.
And then he's like, you know, he says it in a vulgar way, but he's like, I'm going to go find her.
Jesus.
But cool. Now he's in this world. And I'm like, I would love to see the sequel where Upgrade is in this world trying to get to Maya Rudolph. And he's also from our time, so he's smart. And he's a businessman.
He's smart. You know?
he's a ruthless businessman.
That actually, my nominee for this would be the, I think it's like the army colonel in the beginning of the movie, which I actually thought was one of the funnier bits, which was when they're talking about how they found Maya Rudolph's character and got her to participate in this experiment, is like this army colonel explaining how he just like ingratiated himself into the pimp world. And it does kind of play at the expense of like the black community, the sex worker community, but there's something very funny about his genuine interest and respect for the world. He's like, it's a fascinating world that I took a lot of time to get to. So like, I would watch that movie of an army colonel, and it could be like a real dialectical materialist read on like this army colonel ingratiates himself with the sex worker community and has his entire worldview changed.
I'm about that one. I love that scene.
Listen, this is hard.
You don't have to have a nominee.
Oh, I do.
It's okay.
I think I've only not had one once. These are our awards, and I will be giving one. This movie, I guess, to go with who it should have been about, it should have been about Maya Rudolph's character, Rita. That's the point of view I would want to see this from, and not like her playing this ridiculous part. Like, I think that's a fascinating premise, that she's coming here potentially as like this world is giving her a certain amount of freedom. And like you were saying, James, like she does have this interesting point where she's like, oh, I'm not going to go back because I want to go work at Starbucks here. Like it's better for me here. And there is something, if they'd given her any kind of dimension, that could have been interesting to explore. So I want to see that.
I second that one.
And I want to see inside of Starbucks. I was like, what is the latte? What, like, if you're like, I want
the full latte.
I want the full weird and like what they think. And like seeing these people who are so alienated from sex actually experience real pleasure. That would be really cool, too.
And as like a, you know, as like a sex worker, she has like a fundamental understanding of like economics and how business works. She could
be giving people orgasms for the first time and make a lot of money and then become the capitalist and then have to like deal with that.
Mike Judge, if you're listening, don't make this movie. You'll ruin it.
Give us license. Yeah.
James, this has been awesome, dude. Thank you so much again for being here. Last thing we like to do is ask our guest if there's one thing you do in your everyday life where you get a chance to practice your anti-capitalist values, whether that be like an organization you work with, a practice you engage in. I know you have your own anti-capitalist clothing brand. Is there anything else that you do where, you know, you get to practice your values in your day-to-day life?
Outside of that, like my favorite thing that I've been forced to do because of Comrade is like everyone has to be a content creator. I love educating, just the idea of trying to take complex ideas. And I think, you know, there's basically three activities that you can be doing as a real leftist. It's either agitation, education, or organization. And I'm not the best organizer. I'm good at agitating. So, but the education, the reason that I have this is because I'm trying to make a Marxist Capital for Gen Z.
That's
amazing.
Yeah, a little series.
Hell yeah.
That's so cool.
K Burbank inspired me.
Oh, cool.
Oh, that's dope. And where can our audience find you and Comrade Workwear?
At Comrade Workwear on TikTok or Instagram. Easy. Or .com, where you can buy my things, please.
I can't say it enough. Like, not only is James like a very smart dude, as you've heard, like all of the stuff that he makes at Comrade like looks dope. Like it looks like stuff that you want to wear every day. So go cop a tee, go cop a fit.
Yeah, Rib, I got to get you something.
I mean, I wasn't going to say anything. I was just going to sit here and wait. So thank you.
James, thank you so much, man. This has been
a great conversation.
Thank you all so much for listening. Make sure to follow us on Instagram and TikTok. And if you want to support this show and get access to our bonus episodes, you can find the link to our Patreon in the episode description or by going to mvcpod.com.
For next week, we won't be discussing one movie. We'll be discussing a lot of them because we're going to talk about the Oscars.
AKA the Academy Awards. Ever heard of them? We'll see you next week.
Bye.